Well, last time we were together, we finished the book of Leviticus, the book of rules for the Levites, for the Aaronic priesthood. And now we are ready to go to the book of Numbers, chapter number 10, and start getting ready to leave Mount Sinai and head off to the Promised Land. So if you go ahead and get into the book of Numbers, chapter number 10, and we will talk about a signal system that they needed to use for their trips from here on out, as well as their yearly procedures and their warfare procedures for the rest of their time as an Israeli nation. So Numbers chapter 10, verse 1, "He who is spoke to Moses, saying, make two silver trumpets." So the trumpets we're about to talk about are not shofar trumpets. They're not ram's horn trumpets. These are actual metal trumpets. And there's two of them. More than likely, these trumpets will have slightly different tones to them. And I'll explain what I mean by that in just a moment. Different notes that they sound. "So make two silver trumpets of hammered work, you shall make them, and you shall use them for summoning the congregation and for breaking camp." So these are going to be signal trumpets. Now, our military in the United States, right up until the present time, has used trumpet signals for at least part of their gathering procedures. It's more of a traditional thing nowadays, but in the early 1900s, it was still a matter of practicality because we didn't have widespread long-distance communication like walkie-talkies and things like that. So you had trumpeters that would be near the commander, and the commander would give orders, and that trumpeter would sound certain signals that everybody knew in the army, what that meant. They'd even have signal trumpet sounds for different parts of the army. Now, that idea went all the way back into ancient history, because the trumpet was an excellent tool of communication. It could be heard over a long distance, and it could have distinguishing sounds in short bursts that could be already memorized as meaning some sort of order. So that's what we're seeing here for the Israelis. These will be used for giving long distance communication to the big group of Israelis. Verse 3. "When both are blown, all the congregation shall gather themselves to you at the entrance of the tent of meeting." So this is my reason for thinking these trumpets must have different notes as their base. Because when you hear both of them blowing at the same time, it doesn't sound like the same trumpet. It sounds like two trumpets blowing at the same time. There's some sort of offset to it, some harmonics going on there. So if both trumpets are blown at the exact same time, that means everybody gathers to the front of the tabernacle. This is a public meeting. Verse 4, "But if they blow only one, then the chiefs, the heads of the tribes of Israel, shall gather themselves to you." So one of the trumpets means only the leadership. Then verse 5, "When you blow an alarm," and we don't know exactly what that alarm sounded like, but it would have been a distinctive sound. Now again, in the military, even in our traditional time, there is one trumpet call for waking up in the morning. There is another trumpet call for putting the flag down at night. There's another trumpet call for gathering to eat. There's another trumpet call that was used in order to assemble in a certain location. that, again, it goes farther back in history that there were even more than that. Some of those are just the more traditional ones that are still around. But the Israelis would have known what these different sounding alarms or notes were about. So when you blow this alarm, the camps that are on the east side shall set out. And you remember that the tribes are all set up in different locations in relationship to the center of the encampment. And so the east side, that would be the Judah tribe and its two associated tribes, Issachar and Zebulun. So first warning signal, that's when the first group of tribes move out. When you blow an alarm the second time, the camps that are on the south side shall set out. An alarm will be blown whenever they are to set out. And when the assembly is gathered together, you shall blow a long blast, but you shall not sound an alarm. That verse is just reminding you the signal with the true two trumpets blowing at the same time is going to be different than the signal that the different encamped groups start moving out in the procedure of moving to the next place. There's these distinct sounds that are going to be here, which only could have been passed down if there'd been a way of annotating music that we don't seem to have amongst the Israelis. The sons of Aaron, the priests, shall sound or blow the trumpets. The trumpets shall be to you for a perpetual statute throughout your generations. So it's the priesthood that's responsible for the blowing of the trumpets. They are at the center of the camp, at the front door of the tabernacle, and so they're the ones that are orchestrating the move from one place to another. It is interesting that this idea of the priests using trumpets to signal things goes way, way into the future from where we're reading right now. When I was in Israel the last two times, I loved going to the southwest corner of the Temple Mount, because there in the debris at the base of the mount is what remains of the trumpeter area that used to sit up on a tower on the southwest corner of the temple. Josephus seems to make reference to this, that this is the place where the priestly trumpeter would blow the signal that the Sabbath was about to start or that the Sabbath was about to end. And so we have archaeological and written records that this was still going on around the time of AD 70. So that means it definitely was going on in the time of the New Testament. All right, verse number 9. When you go to war in your land against the adversary who opposes you or oppresses you, then you shall sound an alarm with the trumpets, that you may be remembered before he who is your God, and you shall be saved from your enemies. And we'll see this when we get to the book of Judges in particular, that the trumpet gets sounded on several occasions, that everybody needs to gather because we need to go to war. We need to defend Israel. On the day of your gladness also, and at your appointed feasts, and at the beginning of your months, you shall blow the trumpets over your burnt offerings and over the sacrifices of your peace offerings. They shall be a reminder of you before your God. I am he who is your God. So these trumpets are used for everything that would need a signal for everyone to get on board with the timing. For this example, the way they decided the beginning of a new month is that they were supposed to be ready to spot the first crescent of the new moon as the sun set. And they'd have a good idea when it was going to happen, so they'd be watching for it. And the moment that they saw it, right as the sun went down, they would blow a trumpet. And then presumably, based on other traditional things that we've seen, they would light signal fires and on hilltops all across the land, so that within a matter of minutes, everybody would know this is the beginning of our new month. And they would do the same thing for whenever they were doing the sacrifices each day. You know that there were two sacrifices, the mid-morning sacrifice and the evening sacrifice, that were prayer times. These were times when the incense was offered. This was the time of prayer that we see that is even mentioned in the New Testament. And so everybody needed to know when that started. So they would have a temple priest sound the trumpet for that particular moment. And then everybody would realize, oh, it's time for us to take just a moment and wait for the offering of the sacrifice. And then there would probably be a signal to let you know when the priest had come out and made his blessing. And so the time of sacrifice, the time of incense, the time of prayer was finished. We have something very similar that has been utilized by the Muslims, if you want to see a modern-day example of this, where they will have their mullahs make that prayer call before the sun comes up in the morning at some point, I think, and then I believe mid-morning, noon, afternoon, sometime right around sunset. So they'd have all these different calls of prayer to have a signal to let the Muslims know it's time for you to do your worship. Again, having been in Israel and seen that, it is a strange procedure to happen right in front of you, because one moment the marketplace will be just bustling, and then the mullah will start making that call, and everybody disappears. You'll have to wait until the signal comes back that they're ready to come back to prayer. Well, something like that was probably going on in the tabernacle and in the temple each day during the time of morning sacrifice and afternoon sacrifice. So these are to be used all sorts of communication procedures, all sorts of ways. I think it's also the reason in the book of Revelation that we have the trumpets and the bowls representing the exact same seven wrath events, because the bowls were poured out at the signal of the trumpet. And so they are synonymous, and that's kind of a secondary thing, but I did want you to see there's a good reason from the procedures in the temple to understand that in the book of Revelation. Well, verse number 11, it says, in the second year, that'd be the second year of the Exodus, in the second month, on the 20th day of the month, the cloud lifted from over the tabernacle of the testimony. So on our calendar, let's see, I have that somewhere at the very beginning of June in 1455 BC. The reason this is important is because the Israelites had been told, if you see the glory of God lift up off the tabernacle, that means we're moving. So everybody that saw that happen after the sun went down and the 20th day of the month began knew, oh, I need to start getting packed up, because tomorrow morning we're moving out. The signal trumpets will sound, and our different groups are going to be marching to the next place. So verse number 12, the people of Israel set out by stages from the wilderness of Sinai, and the cloud settled down in the wilderness of Paran. Now, that's where it will settle down eventually, and Numbers 31 actually has the list of, 33, I think, has the list of all the different stages where the tabernacle was set up. And we have in, chapter number 33 of Numbers, verse 16, they set out from the wilderness of Sinai and camped at Kibroth Hattaavah. And so that's where we see the parallel to where we're at here in Numbers chapter 10, verse number 12. So they're moving from point A to point B, God doing the direction. The principle was everywhere God's presence settled down, that's where they build the next tabernacle. If he didn't settle down with his presence in a particular place, that would mean probably just a temporary quick rest for the night and then moving on for the next day. Verse number 13, they set out for the first time at the command of He Who Is by Moses. And then we have all these details about the camp breaking down. The standard of the people of Judah set out first by their companies, and their commander, the company of their commander was Nahshon, the son of Amminadab. We've went over these names once before, so I'm going to shorten it to basically the tribe and the commander. And then verse 15, over the company, the tribe of the people of Issachar, Nethanel. Over the company of the tribe of the people of Zebulun, Eliab. And then the tabernacle was taken down, and the sons of Gershon and the sons of Merari who carried the tabernacle set out. So the first three tribes on the east side, they take off first following God's glory. Then we've got the Levites, the priests who are carrying the ark and all of that, they're leaving. The tabernacle is in the process of being broken down at this point so that it can be taken away in its different carts. Verse 18, the standard of the camp of Reuben was under Elizur. The tribe of the people of Simeon were under Shalumiel. The tribe of Gad under Elsaphath. Then the Kohathites set out, carrying the holy things, and the tabernacle was set up before their arrival. So we're getting into this story that as they're moving to the next place, which is probably going to be 15 miles or so down the road, the camps are going to know exactly where the tabernacle is going to be set up. So Judah and his associated two tribes, they're going to be starting to set up their encampments to the east of the area where God's presence has settled down again. And then you're going to start seeing the arrival of the guys with the Ark of the Covenant and the table and all of that, plus those that have the equipment necessary to reconstruct the tabernacle. So those are all starting to be put in place by the time that the Ark of the Covenant has arrived and getting ready to be put in place. And then we've got all the other tribes showing up as that's happening. So verse 22, you've got Ephraim with Elishama at the head of that, and then you've got Manasseh with Gamaliel, and Benjamin with Abidan. And then you've got Dan under Ahiezer as the rear guard. And then Asher, of course, is with him, and Pagiel is at the head of that group. And Naphtali is also with Dan, and Ahira is the leader of that group. And so this was the order of march, the people of Israel by their companies, when they set out. So they are very systematic, moving from one point to the other. God is the one that's leading them, but he expects them to be very organized. They have signal trumpets. They know who leaves first, who comes next, when the tabernacle is dismantled, by whom, and how it marches, and then the setup once they arrive at the next site. All of that is well planned out and very quickly orchestrated. And a camp like this can go up in a matter of hours if you are organized. Back when I was in the military the second time, I, of course, was activated and went off to Gulf War I, Desert Storm. It was Desert Shield when we first arrived in Saudi Arabia. And we were a medevac unit, a medical evacuation unit. And we had to set up a tent city at the end of a runway. And the Seabees had already built our little concrete pads by the time we arrived. They were already cured and ready to go. And within a matter of hours, we had our hospital tents up and all of our residence tents up, and had already started making some of the other areas around our encampment. So when you've got a plan, when you've got an organization such as God has given to these guys, you can break down and set up these camps very, very rapidly. Verse 29. Moses said to Hobab, the son of Reuel, the Midianite, Moses' father-in-law. Now, there's a little confusion perhaps to some of us reading this in English. Reuel is the one that is described as Moses' father-in-law. Remember that Reuel seems to be a title. Reu is the way you say shepherd in this ancient language. El is God, so the shepherd of God. He was the priest of Midian, and Moses married his daughter. Reuel had actually come to Moses at Mount Sinai about a year earlier than what we're looking at right here, and had stayed with him for a while and even given him some advice. And evidently, Reuel was accompanied by his son, Hobab, so Moses' brother-in-law. Hobab has apparently stayed around for the last year, or maybe he's back for a visit. One way or the other, he is in the camp when Israel is breaking everything down and moving to its next location. And so Moses says to his brother-in-law, Hobab, we are setting out for the place of which he who is said, I will give it to you. So we're getting ready to go to Canaan, and God has told us he's going to hand Canaan over to us. We're going to evict the Canaanites at God's command, and then we're going to take over the property. This is what he says to his brother-in-law. Come with us, and we will do good to you. For he who is has promised good to Israel. So he evidently likes his brother-in-law. He wants his brother-in-law to come along and join him in the promised land. Verse 30, but he said to him, I will not go. I will depart to my own land and to my own kindred. And then Moses said, please don't leave us. For you know where we should camp in the wilderness, and you will serve as eyes for us. And if you do go with us, whatever good he who is will do to us, the same we will do to you. So Hobab is seen by Moses as someone that would be helpful to have around, because he evidently knows the region. Now, I'm less concerned that the Israelites need to know the exact site of the encampment, because God is the one that's directing that. I think what Moses is communicating is, you know the territory around here, and you know where all the water holes are, and where all the wild game might be. You also know where good neighbors and bad neighbors might be located. I'd like for you to stick around and kind of help us as we make this last little move toward the promised land. And this is what I will guarantee you, Hobab. You stick around here, and the Abrahamic blessing will be true. Remember the Abrahamic blessing? God said to Abraham, I will bless those who bless you and curse those who curse you. So that's what he's offering to Hobab. And it turns out that Hobab will go with them, he and other members of that family group. And they will actually become kind of affiliated with the Israeli people. But they will never, well, I can't say never, but for the longest time that we see them in the history of Israel, they will not be living in permanent houses. They will instead maintain a Bedouin lifestyle. One of the key people that we're going to read about is Jael, who is part of this family group that is living in tents during the period of the judges. She is, and her family are affiliated with the Israelis, but they are not Israeli. And we will be intrigued by their interaction with the Israeli people and non-Israeli people also. All right, let's wrap up things for today by wrapping up the last part of this chapter. Verse 33. So they set out from the mount of He Who Is, 3 days' journey, and the Ark of the Covenant of He Who Is went before them 3 days' journey to seek out a resting place for them. Now, 3 days' journey, I think, is going to bring them to the encampment that needs to happen because the Sabbath is coming up. So they leave on the 20th, they're traveling on the 21st, and then on the 22nd, that's going to be a Friday, so they need to finish their travel on that day and set up their encampment so that when the Sabbath, the 23rd in this particular year, on this particular month happens, they're already in place. So 3 days journey, it takes them to get to this first Sabbath encampment after Mount Sinai. Verse 34, the cloud of He who is was over them by day, wherever they set out from the camp. And whenever the ark set out, Moses said, arise, O He who is, and let your enemies be scattered, and let those who hate you flee before you. So there had this ceremony that when the ark of God was being moved from its place in the tabernacle, as the Lord's presence has risen up and signaled, and it's time to move to the next place, they would phrase these words to God. God is rising up. His enemies need to run away. And then when they arrived at the next site and God's visible presence settled down, they would put the Ark of the Covenant back into place in the tabernacle. And then, verse 36, when it rested, that is, when it came back into the tabernacle at the next camping site, Moses said, return, He who is, to the 10,000s of thousands of Israel. So they had this nice little ceremony of departure and arrival, where the king is the one that's leading the march out, and the king is the one that's finishing the march as they come to the next place. And I love the symbolism that is involved in that, in letting the Lord take the lead in all things. If only we would be as attentive to that sort of attitude toward Jesus, that Jesus is our King of Kings and Lord of Lords, and whatever He says, that is what we will do.